Resilience is about sustainable improvements in standards of living. We need not just to generate near-term gains, but to prevent future backsliding that erodes those gains. That's a very different way of thinking about poverty and also poverty reduction programs.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Can anti-poverty programs make it less likely that households will fall back into poverty in the future? Building and measuring resilience may be more complex than it seems in development contexts, especially given the impact of events like climate change. Loki Federa of the World Bank and Hope Michelson from the University of Illinois were two of the researchers who did one of the first studies into the impact of development assistance on household resilience, and they both join me now. Welcome to Vox Dev Talks, Loki.
Hi, Tim.
And welcome, Hope.
Hi, thanks for having us.
We need to describe what resilience means in development, don't we? What happens, I suppose, when households are not resilient?
Yeah, I want to make a really important distinction at the outset between development resilience and other field resilience concepts. So it's a really commonly used concept in ecology and also in engineering. And those fields, what they tend to think about when they're talking about resilience is the ability of a unit or a system to persist or recover after experiencing a disturbance or perturbation. So development resilience builds on those ideas. But what we're going to do is think about how individuals or households' well-being and livelihoods are affected by those kinds of perturbations. And a big difference that I want to emphasize between development resilience and the concept of resilience in other fields is that development resilience is not just descriptive. So it has normative foundations. The idea is that resilience, in particular, more resilience will be better for individuals and households. The idea is that these kinds of development assistance programs could affect resilience, and that resilience itself could be an objective for development and for households and for interventions designed to assist them. So we're going to implement the concept of development resilience proposed by Barrett and Constance in a 2014 PNAS paper. And what they say is that development resilience is the capacity of households and individuals over time to avoid poverty in the face of stressors and in the wake of shocks. And that way of thinking about resilience can be applied to a range of individual and household well-being outcomes. So food security resilience, consumption resilience, income resilience. And so a non-resilient household then is a household with a probability of falling into poverty in the future, even if that household's not poor today, right? So that gives us this additional way of thinking about current and future household welfare status. So it's not just where they are today, but where they might be in the future, given the risks that they face. So being resilient involves facing a low likelihood of being poor in the future, even if bad things happen.
Why might this affect the way that we design and deliver anti-poverty programs?
The resilience concept, it encourages us to go beyond the first moment of household welfare distribution. It allows us to sort of think more on the stochastic welfare dynamics, also in possible nonlinear welfare growth paths, and also the shocks and the stressors that household may face, right? So this has three main implications in terms of how we think about delivering anti-poverty programs. First, in terms of design, the resilience concept proposed for more multifaceted approach to achieve longer term improvements in household well-being. And this could be done through increasing capital now, increasing both human capital or physical capital, or bundle of inputs for future well-being. And then second is decreasing downside risk. And this could be changing the risk exposure or providing safety nets, insurance, access to credit to lessen the effect of realized risk. And then third is in terms of changing structural impediments to development. This could be legal, this could be social norms, this could be discrimination against certain groups. Also, it could be geographical isolation. So while many of these anti-poverty programs that we see already focus on the first, usually increasing capital now, but resilience framing suggests to account for risk and structural factors equally. And then second, it is in terms of how we think about targeting of programs. Development resilience sort of changed the way we think about it. It's just because households that could be observed non-poor now and then they wouldn't be qualified for the programs.
Mm-hmm.
But they may not have capacity to sustain that status over time. The concept is ex ante. So that means we could use resilience instead of the static measure of observed poverty for targeting. And this could be an improvement. And then third, many of the households that are observed non-poor, that might be transient. So these households may not be able to sustain that status. Resilience is about sustainable improvements in standards of living. We need not just to generate near-term gains, but to prevent future backsliding that erodes those gains. That's a very different way of thinking about poverty and also poverty reduction programs.
It's also multidimensional. As you describe resilience or lack of resilience, the concept's an umbrella for many things that might happen in the future. So it strikes me that it's very difficult to measure it. It's very difficult to report it. And you have to make some assumptions along the way. How do you do this?
That's very interesting question and important questions, I think. Mm. There are still range of ways that researchers define and measure resilience. And some work tries to think about resilience as exposure to shocks and the adaptive capacity to bounce back. But the key feature in this field is thinking carefully about modeling the dynamics of welfare status of households. As we noted in our paper, we focused on the probability of remaining non-poor in the future. So what we do is we estimate the conditional mean of household well-being status. Then we use those predicted means from those regression equations to estimate variance, right? The second moment of the households. So that allows us to estimate what we call the resilience scores. So these are basically the probability or the likelihood of falling into or the above poverty line in the future. So estimating resilience is data-driven, is data-intensive. It requires collecting panel data. So in our case, we use 6 rounds of data collected on the same households over 42 months time period. And then also, as you rightly pointed, that it requires some critical assumptions in terms of estimations.
Mm-hmm.
So one critical assumption is classifying household into resilient or non-resilient households, just like poverty status, whether the household is poor or non-poor, and we use poverty line. So in terms of resilient, we don't have such equivalent of poverty line. So as of now, it's all subjective and we don't have any theoretical backing. And then in our case, we use a probability of 0.5. We sort of follow the literature. That's what been practiced. And for the main specification, that means the households that have at least 50% chance of remaining non-poor in the future would be considered as resilient. The current estimated moments, right, the mean and the variance tell us about the future. It's just because the nature of the concept itself, right? It's an ex-ante concept. So that means the past realization can estimate the path dynamics of the likelihoods of being poor. And the goodness of fit of the regression equations that we use to estimate both the conditional mean and the variance is sensitive towards the choice of variables that we use to explain those equations. This is not only limited to resilience measurement, but also equally applicable to other regression equations as well.
Let's have a look at how you put this into practice, because you investigated an asset transfer program in Zambia, in a Copper Belt province in Zambia, looking at whether that had made households more resilient using these techniques. First of all, what were the lives of the households like before the intervention? How resilient would they be?
The villages where we were able to do this study in collaboration with Heifer International are located in the Copper Belt province of Zambia. That's in the north central region of the country, and it's an area that is known for copper mining. It's close to the border with the Democratic Republic of Congo, but it went through a really difficult economic transition about 30 years ago. So these were areas where there was a lot of dependence on the copper industry, on mining, and as that collapsed in the 80s and 90s, there wasn't a lot of other economic activity. So some of this land, which is mostly unoccupied forest, was given by the government to some of the former miners. And when the project started about 15 years ago, livestock rearing was not common. These were small villages that were quite isolated from markets that were mostly relying on low productivity agriculture, and there were high rates of poverty, food insecurity, and child malnutrition. So we can see all of that in our baseline. And I'll just talk a little bit about the eligibility because it relates to your question about, you know, what the conditions were of households. So communities and households had to pass a screening process. This is pretty standard with these kinds of heifer projects and then with these big asset transfer projects more broadly. So community members organized themselves into groups and submitted an application. And there's a screening that excludes the poorest members of the community. But even so you don't want to think about this being the poorest people in the communities. And there's reasons for that, right? Concerns that they're not going to be able to make the kinds of coordinated investments that are required to be successful in the project. But at baseline, about 60% of the households in the sample in the project were living on less than $1.90 a day at baseline. So these were not places that had a lot of other kinds of economic activity. And any household with professional employment or sufficient assets was also screened out. So the tails of the distribution are screened out, and it's a real focus on the middle of the distribution, welfare distribution in the community.
This could, as I understand it, be characterized as a big push intervention. We've talked about this type of intervention a couple of times on Vox Dev Talks. In this case, what was the treatment? What was the intervention? And what do we know about its impact on poverty?
As you point out, these productive assets grants have become an important tool in program design to help household transition out of poverty. And several recent papers have focused on measuring the effects of these big push interventions. Some of these papers, including the recent Banerjee, Duflo, and Sharma paper that you feature on this podcast.
We did, yes.
That assess the long-term impact of the graduation programs, right? Mm-hmm. And then finds that the program was indeed helpful, sort of impactful, you know, long after the program ended. So the program that we evaluated was implemented by Heifer International as an NGO, and is similar to the big push intervention that you described, and similar to the, you know, graduation, the BRAC program in Bangladesh. It transfer this one-off productive assets to the households. And then in our case, these were mainly pregnant dairy cattle. Mm-hmm. And at the same time, it provided provisions for agricultural and veterinary extension services, as well as livelihood trainings. One of the requirements was for these participants to build improved cow sheds for the livestock, and also contribute towards livestock insurance fund. So in case in the loss of livestock, or if you need to cover the medical expenses for treatments. And given that it's a pretty big big transfer, and also the program's financial constraint, not all qualified communities received transfers at first. So we used to exploit this rollout to measure the impact of these program. So those who received early on, those are treated groups, and those who are still waiting to receive the transfers, we use them as the control group. But both the groups went through the same screening and the selection process, and the eligibility was equal for both the groups. And also we assume that because those two groups were comparable on observables, we assume that these are also comparable or unobservable to establish causal relation. And using the standard impact evaluation methodology of sort of estimating only the means, i.e. the first moment of the welfare distribution, we reconfirmed the results from these other papers that focuses on this, evaluating these big push interventions. The program had increased household asset accumulation, mostly in terms of herd size. And then we also see that the treated households have increased revenues, especially through livestock. And we see big improvements in terms of both food and non-food expenditure. The treated households had 60% more expenditure than control households, translating to significant improvements or the reduction in poverty rates. After first year, we see that the treated households were 22% less likely to be poor than the control group. And then this probability of being poor had even widened, right? After 3 years, that had gone to like more than 30%. And then in terms of food security, we see that significant number of treated households tend to be more food secure. They tend to report that they have enough food for household consumption.
These are great results in terms of the immediate impact of the program, but using the methodology that you outlined earlier, were you able to estimate the impact on resilience for these households? And how difficult was it to do that? From what you said, it sounds like this isn't the sort of thing you do on the back of an envelope.
I think the real contribution of the paper is to demonstrate the kinds of insights that focusing on resilience estimation can provide in this kind of an impact evaluation, as you highlighted already, Tim. So First of all, both the resilience and the difference in difference, the kind of standard impact evaluation results, suggest that this program had big improvements in household welfare. So Loki just talked about the kind of standard impact evaluation framework results, where we look at the effects on food security and expenditure, and we see these broad and significant, economically significant effects. But what's interesting and important is that the resilience results show the program has improved households' ability to remain non-poor into the future. So that's a different way of understanding program effects.
Yeah.
The program increased household resilience. The households that received the training and the assets were, we estimate, were 44% less likely to be poor in future periods. And relative to the control group, the recipients had significantly higher resilience to poverty in all three rounds. So big numbers, very significant. But what that means, the insight there is that we learned something new about the likely durability of the estimated program effects on poverty. Loki talked about how we look at both what happens to the mean of the asset distribution and then also the variance. And so we can see that the program increased mean assets, but it also decreased the variance. So it shrank the variance. So that's giving this upward shift in the household's conditional asset distribution, but it also decreased the risk that households are facing associated with that capital stock. That's how we interpret those results. So then there's one additional little piece of this that's really important. Our resilience estimates show that some of the households, in particular, some of the later recipients that we incorporate into the analysis, who are classified as non-poor at end line, do not have as high of a likelihood of remaining non-poor in the future. Does that make sense? So we see for the original recipients, things look great and they're much likely to be poor in the future. But for some of the later recipients, it doesn't look as durable. The effects don't look as durable. So this provides some nuance into understanding what those kinds of long-term effects are going to be and for whom.
Can you explain the changes in the lives of the people who have received this intervention? What changes in their lives are making them more resilient?
The program uses the asset transfer and the skill training program as a means of facilitating and encouraging the rural household, especially rural women, transition away from less remunerative, more variable, casual work they used to be employed in to more capital-intensive self-employment activities that are characterized by greater and more stable returns. So in this paper, we document exactly this. We find that these treated households are transiting away from these employment in casual labor to self-employment activities. And then we see that these impacts are persistent beyond 3 years after the program. And then we also observe significant increase in total household income, mostly coming through livestock revenues, but also we see a decrease in casual labor. Although we see an increase in total income, but we see the decrease in casual labor or the wage income from the casual labor. We don't report this second piece that I'm going to discuss in the paper, but well after the programs ended, went back to those villages and organized focus groups to share the results and also discuss their experiences participating in this program. And women who participated in this program reported a lot of responsibility in livestock rearing activities. They also reported being more involved in household decision making in terms of those livestock. At the same time, they reported a leadership in the community self-help groups. And many of these groups, self-help groups, combine together and establish a co-op for milk sale. The co-op had milk collection facility center, and it also had a storage facility for milk to, and then sold everyone's milk in bulk. So that allowed this co-op to bargain for higher prices. And the co-op also acted as a bank to the members, both lending and then also for saving. And also it sold agricultural inputs. And then all these institutions were run by women. Obviously, this is anecdotal evidence, but what it seems from the participants' reporting is that the project has loosened some of these structural constraints regarding the women's involvement in decision-making and also entrepreneurial activities in the villages where we had this program.
Yes, because programs like this are known for being relatively expensive. Are they value for money? So could including resilience in the way we evaluate these programs change how we think about the costs and the benefits of this type of anti-poverty intervention?
The total per household cost for this program was around $4,500 in purchasing power parity terms. This included both the actual transfer value and also the operation cost. Most of these livestock were transferred from South Africa, so there was a lot of transportation cost. This number is highly comparable to most of the graduation programs that are studied in Duflo, Banerjee, the science paper in 2015. Mm-hmm. So when we did the cost-benefit analysis, we found that the program has benefit-to-cost ratio of about 4.5 with internal rate of return of 24%. And both of these are slightly above the BRAC program and the graduation program reported on the two studies that I just mentioned. Mm-hmm. In the paper, we also present the cost of increasing household resilience headcount by 1 percentage point for different resilience cutoffs. But however, we don't have other observations, right? Other points, results from other programs to compare against. So we don't know whether this is high, low. We don't have any comparison at the moment, but this is still sort of a crude way of measuring the cost to resilience. And this could depend on the project context. So we need some more exploring on that. Talking more broadly and more conceptually, focusing on resilience does require that we think about how durable these estimated benefits from the programs are likely to be than the way we think currently, right? The way we do in terms of cost-benefit analysis. So for instance, instead of assuming that these benefits from these type of programs would extend till like, let's say 10 years or 20 years, we could start using the results from the resilience to estimate the duration of these impacts and also sort of possible attenuations of these effects and then how lasting these impacts are. And this is, I think, one important area of future research.
Listening to what you say, I'm thinking of maybe 20 different papers that we've featured on Vox Dev Talks, where this sort of analysis would be incredibly useful and incredibly interesting as well. But I think what we've mentioned a couple of times already is this is not easy stuff to do. It's quite data intensive. It involves quite a lot of analysis. What sort of tools, what sort of data would the people doing that evaluation need? And how sure could they be of what the data is telling them?
To begin with, related to Loki's last point and the question that you asked him, it could be that in current cost benefit analysis, we could be off in either direction, not in this paper, but in general, we might be overestimating the benefits because, as development is littered with projects that have a nice effect in the near term and then you come back a few years later. And even that near term perspective is rare and the benefits have attenuated significantly. So we could be in these cost benefit analyses overstating effects. We could also be understating effects, right? So I think the question you're asking about what insights this could provide are really important. I think the sense is right now, especially in the humanitarian and kind of practitioner world, that resilience is a really important concept, that a number of humanitarian crises driven by conflict, by climate, by health crises like COVID-19, that's leading a lot of people within, as I said, the humanitarian community and development community to focus on resilience. But as we said before, it's not very well defined and the discussion and measurement is not coherent. So I think the first thing that I would say is if this is going to be a concept that's going to have traction and provide comparable and actionable insight, it would help to achieve some consistency about how we define and measure development resilience. But then focusing on the concept of resilience itself requires an emphasis on the collection of more high-frequency data on households over time. Yeah. And by doing that, we learn a lot of things about households. We learn a lot more about how welfare fluctuates over time and what it seems to fluctuate in response to. Those are insights that are important, independent even of the resilience measurement. So that dynamic measurement, surveying households and individual well-being at high frequency over time, gives us broader insights, but also would allow us to implement the kinds of estimations that we're talking about. Much of our understanding of development processes is still reliant on fairly short panel snapshots of households and communities or even cross-sectional. And we've learned an enormous amount from the data that we have. So thinking about in particular, what kinds of insight we could get from new forms of data, from satellites or other sources, maybe getting a bit creative about how to combine that with standard household survey methodologies, which some folks are beginning to do. And then applying the concept of resilience to that kind of data, I think could be enormously fruitful because we have so much to learn.
There's a lot of work in the future, isn't there? But isn't it amazing to be at the beginning of an entirely new way of thinking about things? It must be pretty exciting for you. Cool. Thank you so much for talking about it today. Thank you, Hope.
Yeah, thanks for having us, Tim. This was a lot of fun.
Thank you, Loki, as well.
Thank you, Tim.
So you really want to read the paper after that, and it's called Do Asset Transfers Build Household Resilience? And the authors are Loki and Hope and Alex Winter-Nelson and Peter Goldsmith. It was published in the journal Development Economics, volume 138, and that was in 2019. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And all our past episodes, as ever, are at voxdev.org, where we also have articles about the papers we feature.